Welcome to Cities and Planners, the podcast about cities from the perspective of urban planners of all persuasions. On each episode, we ask a different planner to tell us about their city, what they love, what they don't love, and how they are working to make it better. I am your host, Christopher Rones, a transportation planner in New York City. Hello, everyone. This is Christopher Rones. Welcome to the third episode of Cities and Planners podcast. Today, we're going to talk about the city of Tucson, Arizona. And I am interviewing Sarah Megason, who is a housing planner for that city. And I was really excited to talk to Sarah for a couple of reasons. The first is I have been to Tucson before. I went there a couple of years ago for a streetcar conference and was able to get to know the city, but mostly from the perspective of that mode and that planning issue, if you will. And I'm anxious and interested to hear about other issues when it comes to planning. Second reason I'm excited is that Sarah is not a transportation planner. Our first two guests were transportation professionals. And though that is something I'm interested in, obviously, that's my focus in planning. It's good to hear from other perspectives. And I've always wanted this podcast to be broader than just transportation. Although that being said, I couldn't resist. And we do talk about the streetcar as well. Now, before we get into the interview with Sarah, just a little bit of background on Tucson, for those of you who may not be so familiar with it. It's located in southern Arizona, very near the Mexican border. Has a population of just about 500,000. The metropolitan area is closer to 1 million or maybe just a little bit more. That's not what I would call a really large city. It's actually only the 33rd largest city in the US. So medium-sized city, certainly doesn't compete with Phoenix, Arizona in terms of either population or the rate of growth. A big part of Tucson is its university. About 50,000 students live in Tucson, or at least attend the university. Presuming most of them live in Tucson. And the university is also the largest employer in the city. This episode, as you'll note, is a little bit longer than some of the others. With Sarah, we talk about a number of issues, both things that she's focused on in her work and other planning issues that I raise. I think it's a great conversation. I think you'll enjoy it. So let's go. Sarah Megason, welcome to the Cities and Planners podcast.
Hello, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. I'm so excited to talk about Tucson today. It's a city, as I mentioned before, that I have had the opportunity to visit, but was only there for a few days and was really focused on the streetcar. So I'm interested to hear more about the city and particularly some of the planning issues that you've been involved in. Before we go there, I just wanted to give you the opportunity to sort of introduce yourself and talk about how you came to work as a planner in the city of Tucson.
Yeah, so I grew up in Denver, Colorado, and I thought I was going to be a music teacher. So I grew up in the suburbs around Denver. And as I got older, it really started to blow my mind how Boulder and Denver became sort of one city as I aged and grew up. So I think that in 2007, I was in my early 20s and I kind of freaked out about Colorado and Denver. And I ended up moving to a really small town in southern Arizona called Bisbee. And sight unseen, crash landed in this really small, old mining turned artist town, and kind of just ran away from Denver and all of the development that was happening. You know, I would just see subdivision after subdivision being put in, and it really kind of freaked me out. So I moved to the middle of nowhere desert, high desert in Arizona. So I lived in Bisbee for 6 years. And while I lived in Bisbee, I got my undergrad degree in sustainable community development. And I also sat as a planning and zoning commissioner and really started to get involved with a lot of community development type work. I worked in Bisbee as more of a kind of an activist planner, and I worked to ban the plastic bag. It was the first city in Arizona to sort of pass plastic bag legislation for, you know, an ordinance in the city. And then the state ended up banning bans. And so one thing we deal with here in the state of Arizona is a legislature that likes to decide what all the cities can and cannot do as far as regulation of certain things like Airbnbs and plastic bags and other stuff like that. So I was in Bisbee and I felt like I needed to further my education a little bit more. And so I came up to the University of Arizona, where I got my master's in planning from the College of Architecture, Planning and Landscape Architecture. And those 2 years getting the master's, I immersed myself in the city of Tucson and sort of fell in love with it. I wanted to work here, but it was hard to find a job right out of grad school. So I ended up going back to Colorado, and I did some planning in Summit County, Colorado, Breckenridge Ski Resort, Keystone Ski Resort. So a lot of ski resort planning, and kind of dove into housing issues up there. So I lived there for 3 years. And then finally, Tucson was starting to grow, and they were starting to hire planners again. And so I jumped at the opportunity and moved back to Tucson in 2019 to start work as a planner in the Planning and Development Services Department. So now pretty much committed here, went from Planning and Development Services over to the Housing and Community Development Department. And now where I currently have my title is Housing Development Manager, and it's a brand new position where we're trying to create the development arm in the city of Tucson for housing. So kind of a storied past that got me here, but I've been here back in Tucson for almost 3 years, and I'm looking forward to staying here a little bit longer and solving some of our problems that we have.
Thanks, Sarah. What about housing most interests you? Like, why did you decide to focus on that as a planner?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because I always thought that I would be a transportation planner. My emphasis in grad school was transportation planning. I was a car-free person for a long time and still do consider myself a little bit of a transportation planner. But the housing opportunity came up in Colorado. It was kind of an opportunity to, you know, get a promotion ultimately and to kind of move my way up and make more money. But also seeing it was a brand new housing department. The intention there too was to become, you know, the public sector development arm kind of function. And there was something really intriguing to me about that. And I think it kind of stems back to the whole reason why I ran away from the Denver metro area was getting into development, but from a public sector point of view, as opposed to private sector. And for me, housing is everything. I mean, if we don't have homes to live in, then what are we even doing? So it's sort of, I think, one of the most pivotal components of community development and city planning, because we need places to live. I'm kind of a really firm believer too that housing's a right, and that we have so many issues because housing has become commodified. I was at a conference and a bunch of home builders were giving a presentation at a planning conference, and you know, they kept using the word product, and it really hit me in a big way, because I personally don't view homes as product. I understand that when you're on a massive scale home developer and in that business, you probably do see it as product, but to me, there's something more human about it. And I think that without housing, we just don't have anything. So I think the passion of housing came from that. There's a side of housing that always scares me, and I kind of didn't understand it, which is sort of the low income Section 8, dealing with HUD and CDBG funds. And, you know, there's a very, it seems a little bit muddy kind of housing world. And I hadn't really ever gotten a part of that. And so finding myself more in this development world of creating housing. But I think the one thing about housing, since it does affect every person, is really starting to understand the continuum of housing that's needed, and thinking about housing as this holistic perspective, so that we're not just building one type of so-called product out there, but we're really building a continuum of opportunity for people to live inside of and grow through. So looking at the continuum and seeing that you have, you know, homeless tent living, you know, nomadic tents, you have supportive sort of bridge housing services to get people out of homelessness, and then moving up into low income rentals, moving up a little bit farther into, you know, maybe low income ownership, and seeing that so often people build only one type of affordable, quote unquote, housing, and that's the low income housing and LIHTC units, where you're just building for a specific income population. But if you don't build something that they could graduate out of and move into, then you're kind of, you know, imprisoning them into that low income system. So I think seeing the potential for creating a continuum so that as people move and grow and evolve their family or evolve their career, that there's a place for them to move into. So also, I am a, you know, sort of elder millennial single person who often struggles and sees the hardship in the housing world pretty much face to face every single day. And, you know, I'm a renter, and I've had this need to, you know, feel like I should buy a house, but realizing that, you know, renting is totally fine. And the housing crisis that we always hear about that's pending in every part of this country, you know, I think that I am more motivated every day because I just hear stories from people who I know very well and very personally, where housing is their biggest struggle in their life, and people getting kicked out because of flippers and all the sort of issues that come with housing. So it is a wicked problem. I think that I like those types of problems. And so I think that's what sort of drew me into housing. I never would have thought that I would be dealing with it. And, you know, at some level, we touch on all kind of components of planning. We're not going to build housing unless there's transportation and transit nearby. And, you know, if we're doing this right, we're really looking at the land use from that holistic perspective and bringing transportation into the mix as well. So I think it just sort of allows me to be that jack of all trades planner that I love to be, and hopefully make a difference at the end of the day. But we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, how is it going? Tell us a little bit more about some of the projects you're working on. And I know you just sort of started in your new position, focusing specifically on housing development. But how's that going for you? And in general, how's that program going in Tucson?
So far, so good. It's been probably the most inspirational, productive, epic 2 months of my entire career. So it's a brand new position. It is grant funded, but they do have the intention, depending on how well we do with spending the monies that we're getting, and, you know, if we are productive in building, it may become a more permanent position. So the Housing and Community Development Department recently brought on a new deputy director who started within the last couple of years. And she, with this group of planners in the housing department, created what we call the SPACE team, and it's the Strategic Planning and Community Engagement. And that team has been super active in working on a Choice Neighborhood grant. The Thrive in the 05 is what we're calling it. So there's a community revitalization area that's been getting a lot of focus for housing needs. The community engagement part of the team has been really focused on updating, you know, basically just entering into the 21st century with social media. And we have an Instagram account that's actually doing really well and doing a lot of outreach for what our programs in the department offer. And also in this last year, they have implemented and City of Tucson's mayor and council adopted the housing affordability strategy for Tucson, which we call the HAST plan. So the HAST plan was basically created in the quickest amount of time I've ever seen a plan created. I think it was less than 4 months, maybe five max, but it was adopted in December of 2021. And ultimately, housing affordability was identified as a high priority by mayor and council. And so therefore, this plan was a strategic effort to provide policy and priority areas to advance, you know, housing affordability in the city. So the plan has 10 policies that are really kind of the focus of my job. So as the new housing development manager, one of my key functions is going to be implementing the 10 policy initiatives outlined inside of the HAST. And I can provide information on that in a link to our wonderful story map that we have online and kind of the plan in general. And then, you know, the main policy that I'm focused on is building capacity in Tucson around affordable housing development. So creating a HCD, Housing and Community Development Department development arm, and also supporting community partners in development. So far my job has been me figuring out how to help facilitate small scale developers who want to develop affordable housing. And since I have planning and development experience, part of my role is figuring out how to make our permitting and development review process a little more accessible for those who maybe aren't used to going through it, like the big home builders. And so I'm working with a couple small local developers who want to put out kind of a missing middle product, and they're really active and passionate about also providing that affordable housing. So that's one policy area. And then another is basically getting into developing and building affordable housing on city-owned land. So we currently have an RFQ out where we're going to be asking developers to come in and co-develop on two small infill sites with us. And the goal and the outcome of that is to provide homes that are affordable to ownership, hopefully, for 80 to 120% AMI. So that kind of work, quote unquote, workforce housing target. And that's never been done in the city before. I was doing that exact work up in Summit County. So we would be building homes that could be deed restricted and sold to people who make 80% AMI. There's a resale cap, you know, to maintain affordability, et cetera. So we're really starting to kick that off. And hopefully these two city lots have been owned by the city for almost 20 years. There was almost a development that happened on one of them, but then the recession occurred and then, you know, the priorities changed and now it's just been sitting there vacant again. So really getting back into the game and actually building something instead of just sitting on the vacant land that we own. Right now it's really exciting. And part of the reason why I have the job is because we do have the American Rescue Plan Act monies coming towards us, and state and local fiscal recovery funds. So we actually have an influx of money right now to spend on acquisition and to spend on some development programming as well. So I have to start. So my goal also is to prioritize and figure out where the areas of opportunity are to start purchasing property, and make sure that we're, you know, promoting housing in key revitalization areas. And the checklist that we have, you know, includes is the if we're going to go out and find a piece of property, does it meet all of these requirements? Is it near a school? Is it near transit? Is it near this? And creating this checklist so that we're identifying perfect, not perfect, but almost perfect areas and starting to acquire more land to then build up the development arm to potentially develop. So it's kind of a lot. And one major project that we're trying to work on right now is submitting a LIHTC, a low income housing tax credit application, kind of last minute and under the wire from the state on an adaptive reuse senior housing project that we have. So the city has been looking at creative ways to provide housing in blighted areas. And so Oracle Road in Tucson is very historic, has a lot of old motor courts. And the city has purchased two of the old motor courts with a vacant lot in between them. And we are going to adaptively reuse and change those hotels, old school hotels, into and then build a new four-story building for senior housing. And seeing that come together in the last 2 weeks has kind of been one of the most exciting things I've ever done. You know, it was a plan, it was an idea. We were maybe going to apply for LIHTC next year, but just based off of the state of how many projects were going in, we knew that we wouldn't have as much competition. So we're just trying to throw it together very last minute. And it's really been eye-opening to see, you know, what kind of hoops you have to jump through to build housing that is obviously so needed, but yet we still have to, you know, jump through hoops, find money and figure it out. So it's still very difficult, but really excited about those opportunities and the funding mechanisms that do exist right now to help with housing. So those are kind of two of the biggest projects going on. Inside of the plan, we also are trying to get into updating our zoning regulations. We have a unified development code at the city, really pulling out the pieces that we've tried to use in the past for housing. So we have some interesting housing things in there, but you know, one of the things we're really looking at doing is making it so that the code doesn't prohibit housing in the future. So the next thing that we're going to be looking at probably within the next 6 months is try to get a by right parking reduction for affordable housing projects. So I'm really excited about because we have this plan and because we have these policies and because mayor and council really support this endeavor, I'm really thinking that we're going to have the opportunity to update our unified development code so that it isn't a barrier to developing housing.
Interesting. One thing when you mentioned adaptive reuse and actually potentially relevant to zoning as well, thinking about sort of the new world we're living in post-COVID with more remote work, you know, I think a lot of cities are thinking about potentially like, are we going to end up with a lot of additional office space that we can't use? Is that something you've started to think about in terms of potentially either, you know, encouraging it among the private sector or being even more proactive in terms of the sort of change in land use from office to residential?
I think so. You know, I think we're still trying to figure out navigating through this last leg of COVID, whatever it is. And you know, the one thing that I always love about planning and it is that there's no right way to do it and that we're always figuring it out as we go along. And I think that the idea of utilizing space and uses, you know, in a different way is going to be the way that we're going to move through a lot of this, you know. So one of the things that the city had pushed for a long time was more mixed use projects and especially around the streetcar, which we can get into more about in a minute. But, you know, we have a lot of ground floor commercial with a lot of the projects and housing projects that have been going in downtown. And we have a lot of vacant ground floor spaces still at this point in time. And I think that, you know, it's interesting when you are intending to promote something and what are the unintended consequences. And that's kind of what we do as planners, is figuring out what we may have gotten wrong And I definitely think that that's an opportunity for things that aren't working anymore, is getting creative and instead of a parking garage that doesn't get filled up, we convert it into housing. Or same with an office building, can we convert it into housing? So one of the things that we are doing in the city, as well as a part of the Housing First program that has been started, and we have a Housing First director, is we have been using some of those funds that are coming from the federal government to purchase old hotels and use them as bridge shelter housing for a lot of our people experiencing homelessness in the city. And one in particular, which is kind of nearby this other housing project, with which is another hotel as well, I got to tour it a couple weeks ago, and it was pretty awesome to see such a successful project. Seeing people who had been out and homeless are now in a pretty decent hotel room and are able to get on their feet and get driver's licenses and, you know, kind of have a safe space and develop a sense of community and provide those supportive services. And, you know, that's all just because someone got creative and thought, how can we, you know, spend these dollars and create a Housing First program? So I definitely see getting creative and thinking about using underutilized spaces for housing is going to be a big topic for the future, for sure. And adaptive reuse in Tucson, especially. So we have a lot of historic zones that are regulated by the city. And then we also have a lot of national registered districts too, where we have a lot of contributing historic structures. So, you know, in the situation with our senior housing project, it's the name is a little funny, but it's the No-Tell Motel, sits literally in the setback. And it was a historic hotel that was built.
Wait, is that that's the real name of the hotel?
Yeah, the current name of the hotel
is
the
No-Tell Motel.
it supposedly, it was originally the Dianza Motel, but someone renamed it. And I think, so the story is it's because it didn't have telephones. So it's the No Telephone Motel, but it's, we'll go with No-Tell and you can use your imagination. but that, you know, that building, it's historic. It's a historic contributing structure and it's in the setback. And so even if we wanted to demolish it, you know, we wouldn't be able to build anything in that setback anyways. And so we're getting 6 extra units, I think, just by leaving that there and adaptively reusing it into something else. So you're maintaining some historic integrity for that district and that area, the Oracle Miracle Mile area, and also getting a little bit more units out of it too. So I'm kind of excited. We've seen that a few times with old motor courts in Tucson being turned into senior housing projects. And so hopefully we'll see a lot more of that. And I do, I get excited anytime I see an underutilized parking lot or parking garage or office building. I definitely am starting to put my creative hat on and think about how it could work to live in it and make it so that people can have homes inside of these underutilized buildings.
And I imagine these hotels are kind of became functionally obsolete as sort of newer, more modern, probably chain hotels started sprouting up.
Yeah, definitely.
Going back, I do want to talk about some other things, but one thing I'm interested in hearing a little bit more about in terms of how you and the city, you know, does this actual like development. And it sounds like of affordable housing, it sounds like it's a public-private partnership. And without getting too into the weeds, like I'd be interested in having a more of an understanding on sort of where your involvement as the city starts and ends.
Yeah, definitely. And a lot of that is stuff that we're going to kind of figure out as we go. I think every jurisdiction kind of does it differently, depending on what works best for them. And so I have ideas coming from Breckenridge, Colorado, where they have been doing housing development as the public entity for many, many years now. and, you know, kind of figuring out what works well and what doesn't. And so sort of how I see this happening is the reason why the city wants to get involved mostly is to ensure long-term affordability for housing. Part of the reason why I moved back to Tucson from Breckenridge was because I thought I would be able to make almost the same amount of money and have a way less cost of living and be able to maybe buy a house. But the minute I got to Tucson in 2019, the market was starting to get extremely hot where, like, you know, I couldn't even buy a house and the affordability started skyrocketing. And so seeing that issue really play out has made housing affordability the priority. And getting involved and becoming the developer or having a stake in the development process allows the city to maybe, you know, not just promote, you know, market rate development from like a zoning or land use perspective, but to have, you know, their hand at the table to be able to control the types of units, the affordability depth, how long it can be affordable for. So I think that that's kind of the main reason why the city wanted to get involved with this. I see it playing out in a couple different ways, depending on the type of project that we would be working on. So in the case of this new senior housing project, it's Milagro on Oracle, we are partnering with a very well-known housing developer, Gorman. And Gorman's done a lot of low-income projects across the country. They really have a handle on being a developer. So it'll be a public-private partnership with Gorman. And we would be, and we would create a, you know, a limited partnership where the city has a stake inside of this partnership, but Gorman really takes the lead. The private developer takes the lead on doing all of the development because they've been doing that for many years. They know what they're doing. But with the city having a stake in this partnership, you know, now we can sort of say what we need it to be. Like, we want it to be senior housing, and this is the target income and the target population that we want to try to support because we know that that's the need. Oftentimes, I think with rental projects, we're probably going to do public-private partnerships. That way, you know, if we bring the land to the table, that really lowers cost for the developer. And then that gives us a chance to ask for the things that we want to be a part of this project to make it better for the public and the common good. And then the other side, and this is something that I had been, you know, sort of mentored on from the Breckenridge team, was doing like a for sale model. Like, this first project, we're partnering with developers. That's what we're out with the RFQ right now. So it would be also a kind of a public-private partnership. We're looking at creating a land trust. And so we would maintain ownership of the land, and then the developer would lease the land from us and then develop the housing. I think the goal is, once we kind of learn how to do it through this process, and really get our feet on the ground and understand the ins and outs of the development process, actually just kind of taking away that private developer, and like Breckenridge basically does the development themselves through an owner's rep. And so they end up doing all of the development themselves. And that works for, especially for like an ownership model, because then, you know, you sell it and then you're out of it. There's no more management that has to happen. Oftentimes the management is the hardest part. So that's why you would want that, you know, other party to help with the management of the project and the rental terms. But, you know, for a for sale model, once it's sold, then now it exists out there as an affordable unit. If it's on land trust land, then when that unit goes to sell, the city still has, you know, we're a part of the transaction at the next sale. And we can also continue to maintain affordability for that for sale home ownership unit. So I see it sort of going both ways, and it's always just going to depend on the project and the resources at hand, but it is definitely going to be a lot of partnering with, you know, private developers out there. We have a lot of private for-profit developers who work on affordable housing, and we also have some nonprofit developers as well. So I think seeing those partnerships, they've worked in the past and we've gotten a lot of units built in the past from that, but I think it's kind of fallen off in the last 10 years. So bringing that back and making it a priority again and getting those relationships going. So I sort of see it happening like that and just depending on the type of project.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm sure there's like, maybe not infinite, but like a lot of different potential models or variations of models that that you can,
yep,
you can experiment with.
Exactly. I'm kind of really, I've been doing a lot of research and reading up on it since I got the job, and there's, you know, there's lots of really interesting things. And I think one thing that I really get excited about is kind of like a co-op land trust model, cooperative housing, where, you know, maybe I see the potential because we have a lot of small apartment complexes, you know, where you have like 8 to 15 units maximum, right? And they're getting, and they were one of our most affordable types of housing in the city, but they're starting to get bought up by outside investors who are flipping them, and they're starting to like double and triple the rents even. And I think it's New York that does like a, I forget what it's called, but like the first right to purchase, if it's like an apartment complex, the tenants actually have the first bid, and if they all want to go in on buying it together, they can create kind of a co-op. It's not just about building new housing either. It's not just brand new single family homes. Like that's not the solution, but how do we get creative with the existing inventory that's out there? You know, keeping people in their kind of naturally occurring affordable units and making sure that those stay affordable long-term. So I think that there's, like you said, almost an infinite number of solutions to creating housing.
Tucson is a good sized city. It's not a small little university town, but it also has a very large university in it. And I'm sure that the university plays a big role in the city in general. I'm interested in the role of the university in housing. And one of the reasons I asked this, I worked as a consultant for a university that it was kind of a unique university. It had a large endowment. I won't mention the name because it was actually a confidential client, but had a large endowment. And it was actually building not only a lot of student housing, but even faculty housing. And at one point working to even build community housing to sort of help offset, you know, the impacts of its growth. I'm just curious what role the university plays in, you know, sort of helping to meet the housing demand for its own population, which of course is not only students, but, and not even, not only even faculty, but, you know, a large number of staff, I'm sure.
Right. That's a really good question. And I honestly don't quite know the answer, only because I'm still so new in this world. So as far as like the partnership that exists right now, I'm not as up to speed on it. I will say, I think that more could be done. And hearing that, what you just said about the university offsetting and building community housing, knowing that they make an impact, like I think that's something that the U of A could do, and that would be wonderful. It's interesting because we have a lot of historic neighborhoods that surround the university, and they have often been where students reside if they're not living on campus in dorms. In the last, you know, 10 years, the university has been working with the student housing tower developers. And so here in Tucson, we've seen a bunch of towers go up in the Main Gate District. We've seen a lot of student housing being built on the private side, right nearby the university. And that has done a lot of different things. It's really changed the character of that Main Gate District. You know, it used to have one story buildings, and now it's all, you know, I think some of them are 14 stories and really big student housing towers, where that's all that the type of people that are in there are students, and some of the rents are extremely high. but it's all brand new and it's very, you know, tempting to the students. So those got a lot of pushback from the community, and you know, kind of goes both ways. Like people were like, oh, it's so tall, they're ugly, monstrosities. But once those got built, then we started to see a lot of houses in these historic neighborhoods kind of come back online to the general public, because they weren't being taken up by students, because now the students were going into these, you know, sort of concentrated towers. I think that that was really great in a way to kind of extract some of the students from the, you know, sort of neighborhoods around the university and sort of centralize them more right by the university. I don't think that they're doing enough. I am myself an adjunct faculty at the university. I'm teaching a career development seminar to the planning students to try to prep them for the real world of planning, as it were. And, you know, I hear lots of horror stories from faculty and staff regarding cost of living in this city. And sometimes I don't think the university is actually taking a very proactive step at solving that, like you said, like providing these additional things. So I think it's something that there's a lot of opportunity for. I've seen a couple of cool projects that they've done, you know, kind of through the design school, through design build, where they built kind of like a habitat kind of model of a house and on a couple of infill lots, but, you know, nothing at any kind of scale that you would write home about, very small projects. There was another project that they had worked on that was really beautiful for housing firefighters on one of the properties they had, and it was also a design build project. So I think that there's things that are happening, but I'm not 100% sure on what the plan is. And I think that's something that I would really like to look into a little bit more. And especially now that we have this, you know, development arm for the city, like what could my role be to help facilitate development like that? And I'd like to look more into that. Yeah, developing housing for faculty, staff, and the community, and seeing how we can make that grow. One thing that's interesting that I hear a lot too is community members who have lived in these neighborhoods around the university for a long time are very anti-student. And I get it, because sometimes students can be very horrible, noisy, annoying, drunk people. But oftentimes students are just people like you and me. And, you know, as grad students and just trying to, you know, live nearby and get to class. And the vilification of students has also caused a lot of problems for housing and things like that. So we just recently passed an ADU ordinance to allow accessory dwelling units in the city, kind of explicitly in the code. Before, we kind of allowed them, but we didn't call them that. And we more had guest quarters, and it was kind of wishy-washy. So we really cleaned it up and are allowing accessory dwelling units, but a lot of the pushback from the neighborhoods near the university were just worried that these students were going to live in these ADUs and make everything horrible. Now, a long time ago, we did have kind of, I think oftentimes with planning, and like I mentioned before, I think it's, we learn from our past mistakes because we didn't know what we were doing or the unintended consequences of something. And there was a developer in one of the historic neighborhoods around the university that came in and just demolished a bunch of historic single family homes and built up these mini dorms that were just like, you know, completely out of character with the neighborhood, huge, looked like they were directly from California. And it was just intended to be student housing off campus, and that traumatized a lot of the neighborhoods for sure. And I think we're still dealing with the whiplash of that sort of bad development pattern that occurred, because we didn't realize in our code that you could build that, right? It was like a savvy developer figured out what they could get, and it just destroyed these neighborhoods and built up sort of a use that was way more intense than I think ever intended. And you had multiple students living in one sort of large sort of single family mansion. And that caused a lot of drama. So we now have neighborhood preservation zones, and it's always a constant battle between the historic neighborhoods that surround the university and students. And sometimes it drives me crazy. But because I think to myself, well, it's not like the university hasn't ever been here. It's always been here. You bought a house in a neighborhood right next to a university. What do you expect to happen? It blows my mind to sort of see how people diss on students and the culture that they provide, while yet also, you know, loving the fact that they have a co-op and a vibrant walkable area, and that's all because of the university ultimately. So there's going to be a lot of room for growth, and I think it's something that I want to look into now in my position is as a community partner, what we can do for more housing. But it's definitely a learning process, especially, you know, since universities don't have to follow zoning codes, you know, they kind of are exempt from playing a part of the city game. Oftentimes, it seems to me like we're not as great of partners when it comes to land use issues, because they don't have to play along with what we have prescribed in our codes. And so it'd be nice to try to come together more, I think, on those types of projects.
Yeah, I don't know too many places where there isn't at least some tension between a university or a college of any size in the surrounding community, unless there's no community there at all.
Yeah.
I told you before that I was gonna ask you about the streetcar. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I'll ask it from a sort of a land use and maybe even a housing perspective. Like, I think one of the things streetcars, you know, they're transportation, but they're also often built, and I don't think Tucson is an exception for this, they're built with sort of economic development and just sort of real estate development in mind, almost as, you know, something that will attract developers. I almost think of it, and I don't think this is true for Tucson so much, but in some cases it's almost like an amenity, right? Like, this is this is something that you can say, oh, look, rent this apartment or buy this condominium, this is one of the things you get, whether you want to use it or not. But tell me from your experience or your perception, what sort of real impact the streetcar has had on maybe getting the type of development the city's interested in, whether that's mixed use or a denser type of development.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it actually is an economic development tool. Of course, it is transit in some sense, right? I mean, it is a transportation line, and I think ultimately it's to move people from point A to point B, for sure. It's along the historic streetcar route. So we did have a streetcar previously along that line, you know, back in the day. So it's kind of like just reinstating the historicness of it as well, which is kind of cool. I think a lot of places put these things in brand new areas, or, you know, they've never had streetcar presence before, but Tucson did have streetcar presence. And it really does. It goes from the hospital by the university, Banner Medical Center, to the Mercado on the west side. And so it cuts through the university. It cuts through the historic 4th Ave sort of, you know, entertainment arts district. It cuts through the downtown core and heads over to the west side under the I-10 to the Mercado district, which is, you know, sort of a new urbanist community that's been being developed over the last 20 plus years, I think, where we've got the Mercado and housing and the historic Menlo Park and A Mountain. So it's not a very long line, and it does get you from point A to point B in that downtown area. I've always told people, because friends of mine will find out I'm in planning or, you know, transportation or something, and they'll always scoff at the streetcar. Whose idea was that? It's the dumbest thing ever. I can walk faster than it can get me there. And, you know, it just slows up traffic, and they just have nothing but complaints about it. But once I explain it's really intended to be an economic driver, and we've really seen that. So there has been quite a bit of development, and I don't have all the numbers. We could do like a separate streetcar series with the people who were involved with it and have know all about the sort of stats on it, but a lot of development has occurred next to the streetcar for sure that I don't think would have happened had it not been there. So we have the Union on 6th, which is a very large housing mixed use project that was on the streetcar route. And it's also in our infill incentive district, which also is kind of along the streetcar route. So you can tell that we are trying to develop in our downtown area with higher density and mixed use as well. And so we've seen multiple of those projects coming online. We've also seen a few affordable housing projects that have come online. So I think there's like 3 or 4 low income senior housing, affordable housing projects that are along the streetcar, and they were placed in part because you get, you know, more points in affordable housing financing, LIHTC and other kind of home funds and HUD grants and things if you are next to, you know, transit. So we've definitely seen a lot of development occurring around the streetcar. Since COVID, the city has made fares free on all of our public transportation. And right now it's currently free till June. They've extended it a couple of times. And there have been, I live right off of the streetcar route, so I can hear the little ding ding of the streetcar, and I use it as well. And there's days where it's packed like a sardine can. And I've been kind of surprised to see it with that many people on it, especially lately. Like if there's an event downtown, people will maybe park up by the university or vice versa. So I'm seeing a lot of use out of it as a transportation function. And then we're also seeing a lot of development occurring nearby it. And I think that that was what it was intended to do as well. I'm pretty sure the whole focus of it was for economic development in some sense too. And it's also spawned off, looking at other transportation opportunities that sort of spur out of it. So there's been talk of doing, you know, maybe another line that goes east-west from the streetcar route. We currently have money and are doing a big equitable transit-oriented development design, ETOD, and we're looking at doing like a high capacity transit that connects the north and the south, and it would connect right through the streetcar line. So I think it was sort of the first thing that we could do with the, you know, I think it was funded through Tiger Grants back then. And it was like the first thing that we could do, I think, that then triggers other opportunities, whether it's development, land use, or additional transportation that's happening. So I'm really excited. I think the north-south route is probably going to be a bus rapid transit, just because that is, you know, a more of affordable solution instead of doing a light rail or something that would provide more infrastructure. But it's been good to see how the streetcar has spawned a lot of interest and you know, potential for all sorts of future projects that might happen. And the people who hate it will always hate it. And it did cause a lot of problems back in the day, but it's really cool. And part of the streetcar route, we have the 4th Avenue Street Fair that happens twice a year, and they shut down 4th Avenue for vendors. And it's a big shopping day. It's all outdoors. And the streetcars were designed for that day so that the streetcars can still run on the other ends of this stretch. You know, so the actual infrastructure was planned for this street fair event. And so I never noticed it until this last street fair where the streetcar ends.
So they're able to turn around. They're able to turn around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The tracks cross the street, and then they can go back the other direction and be facing the right way for traffic. So I never really realized how that was a part of the planning, and that some huge community event like that, that could maintain, and that was a part of the infrastructure that got developed. So I've been really impressed with how it's turned out, honestly. I remember being there like a nerdy transportation planner grad student on the first day that it opened, and getting to ride the streetcar was just super fun. It doesn't go very fast, but I will say I have timed it and I've tried it both ways. It is quicker than walking. Sometimes it doesn't feel like it, but it is quicker than walking.
Yeah, that's something. No, I mean, I think it, as a streetcar, I've looked at a lot of different streetcars, throughout the country that have sort of popped up in the last couple decades. And I think Tucson, you're right, it's primarily, these things are all about economic development, but also if you want to make it get successful, you have to make it sort of at least work and be rational from a transportation standpoint. And I do think, like, as you say, it does actually connect important things, right? It connects the university mm-hmm. with downtown. So I definitely think it's one of the better planned and executed streetcars that have been implemented in the last little while. So Sarah, I noticed when I was looking at the population growth numbers for Tucson between 2010 and 2020, that the overall growth was about 6%, which is, it's something, but for, at least what I perceive as a Sunbelt city, it seems like a pretty low growth number. And I will also say that when you compare it to cities like Phoenix, it's a lot lower. How would you explain that? Would you say that Tucson is sort of more conscious of, attempting to control or limit growth than some other cities in the West or the Southwest?
I want to say yes, but I don't think that it's because we're growth management conscious necessarily. I just think that it's because Tucson is kind of the sleepy small town in Arizona that, before the streetcar, before we had a really good economic initiatives department, like those 10 years and coming out of the recession, we didn't see a lot of growth happening in Tucson. And I think that it was just because we didn't know what we were doing, and that we didn't provide that drive like Phoenix might have, right? Phoenix has a lot more to offer for big developers. They do have, more, it's more appealing to go to Phoenix and build there than it is in Tucson. And that's just because we still kind of operate, in my opinion, on kind of a small town scale. We're the second largest metropolitan city in the state of Arizona, but sometimes it feels like we're working in a very rural small town. So I think that disconnect of understanding like our potential as a city has been a part of it. We don't limit growth necessarily. We have a very progressive water department that has been thinking about water for a long time. Like Tucson's actually really well off and we want development. I just don't think that we were savvy in doing it right. So now that we have things like the streetcar, which, came online during that 10 years that you mentioned, and we have, an economic initiatives department that's being more active in pulling bigger job opportunity builders out here like Caterpillar. And we've got now Raytheon is another one. And then we have Hexagon that's come in. So we're starting to see, larger employers start to become more drawn to Tucson. But I don't think it's because we were like telling them not to come. I just don't think we knew how to tell them to come. And really, I'd like to see the numbers because since COVID happening after, it starting in 2020 and after the census and seeing that population data, we're actually seeing Tucson grow exponentially. So, in planning and development services, before I switched over to the housing department, we had the lowest staff that we've had in 20 plus years and the highest amount of volume of development activity that's happened since World War II. It was kind of crazy because I think that the city manager and the city of Tucson in general thought, oh, the COVID, we should cut all of our fat. I think they were preparing for a second recession. And in a sense, the complete opposite has been happening. We're seeing way more development occurring. We're seeing a lot of people coming in. I think because of COVID and being able to work remotely, we have a lot of people moving to the city of Tucson who can work remotely and chose Tucson because it is cheaper to live here than it is in Phoenix. And it's cheaper to live here than it is in California or anywhere else. That's really kind of cool. And I think people are starting to get hip to how cool Tucson is with, you know, we've got the Saguaro National Park. We've got all these sky islands. It's extremely like recreational friendly. You know, you can ski here one day a year on Mount Lemmon. So a lot of people are starting to discover Tucson. And I think we're going to see those numbers change in the next census. And I think we're going to start to see Tucson grow more. And I, like I said, I don't think it's because we had some sort of growth management in place. It was just, we weren't the most attractive place in Tucson to grow. And I really see that changing. We do have a very environmentally conscious council, and, you know, sprawl has never been liked in Tucson. So we don't grow out as much just because it does get pushback if you're trying to do a rezoning or if we're trying to annex in, you know, nature and the kind of our outskirts desert landscapes. Like it's really hard to get those types of land use projects through because I think that the growth boundary is sort of the public saying no. And a little bit of our land use plan, like our general plan, I think really tries to limit that just unchecked sprawl. But we have so much development opportunity inside our city in infill. We have so many. I mean, that's part of this new excitement in this new position that I have is for land acquisition. I just every vacant lot I drive by that's an infill lot, I just think to myself, what can we build there? Because there's kind of a lot. And, you know, it's completely different than Breckenridge, which, you know, talking to that housing director was. She was like, wow, like that seems like such a cool opportunity in Tucson because you actually have room to grow. And whereas in Breckenridge, you know, they've reached their build out potential. They don't have any more density because they restricted density. They have urban growth boundaries for sure, just because of the Forest Service that surrounds them. So here in Tucson, we don't really have that. We have a lot of infill opportunity. We have some restrictions around us and we have some constraints when it comes to water, but because we've been really proactive, I think like infill there's a lot of opportunity for infill and growth to occur in a smart way. And you know, just seeing those building permit numbers and development services exploding over the last year and a half, I really see this as an upward trend for a little while. So making sure that we're getting out ahead of it, I think is really key.
Great. You know, one thing, if you look at Tucson on a map, is it's very close to the Mexican border. Obviously, it was part of Mexico once upon a time, as were many now American cities. It's also got a significant Mexican-American population. For you personally, are there any interesting examples of how Mexican culture or anything else influences the city's cultural life or life in general?
Yeah, so it's very rich here for sure. Culturally, you know, Tucson is like the oldest inhabited community with the Tohono O'odham. Like we have the old Mission Gardens and we get to say that we've, you know, we have the oldest kind of community in the country because of that rich history of Native Americans here first and then you know Mexican and Spanish, and it's very ingrained into our culture. So the Sonoran influenced architecture in our old barrios, you know, Tucson was built like pretty much by Mexicans and Hispanics, and we have Mexican American settlements inside of Tucson that are just extremely rich and define the character of Tucson. All of our historic barrio neighborhoods, you know, are very appealing, and it's because of that culture, right? I actually have a friend who is a Chicanx, and she is a housing professor. She's a PhD, and she gets really mad at new urbanism because she, in her mind, it's a bunch of white men who took from, you know, the sort of Hispanic culture of building kind of barrio style walkable communities, that those have been around forever. And now all of a sudden we're calling them like new urbanism. Like it's such a rich culture for us here in Tucson to have those types of communities. One thing that there's a book called La Calle written by Lydia Otero, and she it's about spatial conflicts and urban renewal in our Southwest city. Urban renewal, I think, affects a lot of communities, and we all learn that in planning school. And in Tucson, we grazed an entire community to build up our Tucson Convention Center. And, you know, there's a lot of sort of disconnect and discontent from that effort. I think that we got a great downtown out of this, and we have a great convention center, but we also lost a big part of our community. So I think the trust of planning in Tucson was a little bit soured because of that. But, you know, we see, you know, new developments patterning themselves off of these old ways of building community. And it's one of the reasons why I love living here, you know, the old Pueblo and just how rich it is in culture. Another thing that we're seeing, and that kind of came up during the accessory dwelling unit ordinance process, which took a year with a lot of public outreach. And even inside of our housing affordability strategy, we have a bunch of, we have a lot of data basically that shows how segregated our city is. And there's literally a map that shows, you know, what part of the city is white and what part of the city is Mexican and Mexican American. And it is a clean line, basically, that we see. We really see housing segregation in this community because we have South Tucson, where, you know, historic Mexican American families have been living for years and years, generations. And then we see the sort of major white affluent Sam Hughes kind of neighborhoods, and you see this great divide. And so it's definitely something that the city of Tucson has as far as an issue and a problem, and something that we need to try to blend together a little bit more. And then also, I mean, the reason why I love living here is Southwest architecture and design is in my mind really appealing. Not the total Santa Fe style, but like legit barrio style developments, I think are one of the most beautiful things. So luckily a lot of our barrios are now, you know, historically preserved. And we are starting to see, you know, even a friend last night, we were downtown and it sort of felt like it was a more Latinx like community that was downtown last night that we hadn't seen in a long time. And it sort of felt like the Tucsonense is bringing back their culture into their downtown and taking it back for themselves. And that was really kind of inspiring to see. So yeah, Mexico being nearby, it's really great. It's really nice to escape, to go down there. We just went to Oregon Pike National Monument, and it was interesting because I don't think a lot of people were at that monument like you would normally see at a park in Colorado per se. And I think it's because you can see the border and there's fear around it. So it definitely plays into the culture here. And I think it's one of the most beautiful parts of this community that we have such a rich culture with diversity and community. And one thing that we're starting to try to do in our housing is if we are going in and building in these sort of historically rich neighborhoods like the barrios, that we give sort of a first right to purchase to families who have been there for a long time. So, you know, we're not saying it's not race-based at all. It's not it's just has your family lived in this neighborhood? And can you show that you've lived in this neighborhood for a long time? You get to live in this neighborhood before, you know, that white girl, Sarah, who works for the housing department. So definitely really trying to embrace that rich cultural history and maintain it for sure into the future. So yeah, that book, Le Cahier, it really opened my eyes, and it was really important for me to sort of see how our city has been shaped and how we can continue to shape it with respect to the surrounding cultures as well. I think it's really important, but also we have really delicious food. We are a city of gastronomy. We're a UNESCO registered city of gastronomy. So that's pretty exciting. And a lot of that is because of our rich culture around food and localism. And so, yeah, there's so much about Tucson that I love. So I'm stuck here for a little while. I got hooked. Desert rat. Even though, you know, today was 95 degrees, so it was our first really hot day. But
I'm jealous. we're barely getting into the 50s here, but at least spring is on the way.
Yeah, and you know, you won't be jealous like when I'm complaining once we get into June and it's been in the hundreds for a month.
Right,
so
right.
So today's nice, we're embracing it, but you know, planning for a climate and all of that is Tucson has a lot of things to think about. And so I think it's really fun. It was partially like in grad school, I always thought Tucson was like kind of the best city to learn about how to be a planner, because we have a lot of problems and we have a lot of opportunities to be able to address some of these problems. So for me as a planner, I think it's really a fun place to kind of get to hone my skills in urban planning.
Yeah. And I imagine it's, you know, it's not small, as you say, it's the second largest city in Arizona, which is a growing state, but it seems like it's like manageable, right? Like it's not huge, like some other cities.
Yeah.
So you can probably get really involved as a planner in a lot of different issues in a meaningful way.
Oh yeah. And it's kind of funny, like how small Tucson is some days, you know, like just meeting people who know people that you know, and being like, wait, but how have we never met? But you know, these people, it is a very charming, small, big city, small, little, big city. It's kind of funny. Cause like, I think our population is almost approaching 600,000, and then the metro area, you know, incorporating the other, other towns, we're at a million. So, you know, it's not super tiny, but it definitely is a great place. And there's a lot of potential for good development. And kind of circling back and thinking about how I ran away from Colorado because of housing developments. It's kind of ironic to, you know, be a developer, a housing development manager now, working to do just that. But I think ultimately I came full circle, and the reason why I got into it was to make sure that it's done right and not sprawly and horrible. So definitely have excited to try to help, you know, guide Tucson and have better housing opportunities and, you know, transportation and all of the things that community development is in charge of.
Great. Well, unless you have anything to add, I think that's a good note to end it on. Thank you so much, Sarah, for joining us on Cities and Planners.
Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure talking to you about cities and planners.
Thank you for listening to the episode. I am Christopher Rones, and I hope you will join me for other conversations with urban planners about their cities. Goodbye.